Welcome, and thank you for joining us for another episode of KPMG's Inside International Tax, a podcast devoted to recent developments, observations, and trends related to U.S. international tax. I'm one of your hosts, Kristen Gamboa, a managing director in KPMG's WNT International Tax Practice. I'm joined by my co-host, Gary Scanlon, a principal in the same group. Hey, Gary.
Hey, Kristen.
So on our last episode, we discussed the U.S. House of Representatives' expansive budget reconciliation package titled the One Big Beautiful Bill, or the OB3, that was passed on May 22nd. Much has happened since then. Despite significant differences between the House and Senate and among members of each House, the process culminated in the president signing the bill into law on July 4th. In today's episode, we'll explore the major international provisions in the final version of OB3 and discuss some of the wider themes that we're seeing around the legislative process related to tax law. For our discussion today, we're joined by friend of the podcast, Ron Dabrowski, principal in charge of KPMG's WNT International Tax Practice. Welcome back, Ron.
Hey, hi, Kristen. Hi, Gary. Glad to be here.
Before we dive into the details of the provisions in the OB3, let's bridge the gap between the House passing the bill on May 22nd and the July 4th signing into law. So on June 16th, the Senate released its own version of the bill. And on July 1st, the Senate passed this version, which made significant changes to the House bill, most notably by removing Section 899, the so-called revenge tax. This reversal occurred after the G7 nations had issued a statement declaring their commitment to adopt a side-by-side system for the U.S. tax system and Pillar 2, under which U.S. parented groups would be fully excluded from the UTPR and the IR with respect to both their domestic and foreign profits. What exactly this means and how it will be implemented is still unclear, and maybe the subject of a future Inside International Tax podcast episode. But what is certain is that Section 899 is not law today. So the OB3 extends many of the international provisions from the 2017 TCJA and makes additional modifications related to GILTI, FIDI, BEAT, and FTC in significant ways that could have a real impact on the way taxpayers think about their U.S. international tax profile. So with that background, let's jump into the international tax provisions of the OB3. In particular, let's start with GILTI, or should we say necktie. What does the final bill modify with respect to Section 951 Cap A, and why did the name change?
Yeah, thanks, Gary. It probably is important to start with the name because it's a bit of a policy change that's a little underemphasized at this point. But the name changes from GILTI, which, you know, within the name, it's intangible income. We're focusing on extraordinary returns of CFCs. Now, I appreciate the use of the term necktie, but it's a net CFC tested income is our new term that's replacing GILTI. Intangible isn't in that. So it really is a much more pure worldwide tax system. So we're going to still have subpart F. And so your mobile income and your passive income is going to be subject to 21% rates. And then everything else basically is going to be fully subject to U.S. tax, albeit at reduced rates. And we can get into that. But if TCJA was offering at least the fig leaf of territoriality and Section 250A, Cap A was meant to carry out and introduce territoriality, we've kind of walked that back. So Section 245 Cap A is less important now. It's just limited to really pre-CFC earnings, which is kind of strange, and CFC earnings that are blocked by tested losses in other CFCs. So we've really kind of gone away from ordinary income being exempt and an anti-abuse rule to a much more normative provision. So kind of interesting there and somewhat of a sign of the times. But there were a lot more changes to the GILTI regime that are noteworthy. The headline one is that the rate changes. So our Section 250 deduction is going to change. I won't pound away on the math, but the domestic effective tax rate is going to move from 10.5% to 12.6%. So we're going to have a higher rate of tax on our GILTI income And then we had a number of changes to the foreign tax credit regime as related to GILTI. So importantly, our haircut for GILTI taxes, so this is under Section 960D, the haircut moves from 20%, so we would, under TCJA, disallow 20% of CFC GILTI taxes. We're now going to just allow 10%. And if you keep up with the math here, the change in the rate, the domestic effective tax rate, and the change in the credits allowed to allowing 90%, only haircutting 10%, gets you to a global effective tax rate on GILTI of 14%. So it was 13.125% nominally. It's now 14% global tax rate for GILTI. But that leads us into kind of the final big change. We know there was a lot of critique of the TCJA because that 13.125% global effective tax rate wasn't real because we still had U.S. expense apportionment under Section 904 that limited the foreign taxes further. They have pared back expense allocation. So interest expense and R&D expenses are not allocated to GILTI anymore. So there's much closer parity between the foreign tax base on which the foreign taxes are imposed and the U.S. tax base. We don't have these U.S. only expenses that the foreign jurisdiction doesn't see affecting our GILTI inclusion. So a big, big, important change there. Just kind of pulling on that thread a little bit more. We're not going to allocate interest expense or R&D against GILTI. Those expenses are instead going to be shifted to U.S. income. And so it appears at least that these shifted expenses can create or increase the size of a overall domestic loss account under Section 904G, which means that the benefits of the limitation created by the GILTI, if you don't have enough domestic source income to absorb all those interest expenses, future domestic source income can create GILTI limitations. So a pretty decent benefit, a robust view of the whole regime, if that's the way it's ultimately carried through. And while we're here on the topic of foreign tax credits, there are a few technical corrections of note. These are new legislation. So really, we are saying the TCJA wasn't wrong. It was just needed to be corrected. But they're in the nature of technical corrections. So under current law, the Section 78 gross up applied to taxes on PTEP. So taxes on distributions of PTEP under Section 960B, you have an income inclusion. That really made no sense, and this legislation fixes that. So that's a win, just a clear win. And there are also a few others, but a notable one is base differences now are going to move to the general limitation basket. They're currently under current law in the TCJA as drafted in the branch basket, which again made no real sense, and that's been cleaned up. So a lot going on around GILTI and around the foreign tax credit mechanics. So some interesting stuff there.
So moving on to FDII, we have another name change here. Ron, can you tell us about the changes to FDII or more accurately now, FDII?
Yeah, another kind of the same phenomenon, but a different effect. So under the TCJA, our acronym FDII was Foreign Derived Intangible Income. And so we were benefiting just extraordinary returns that led to exported services or exported goods. We're eliminating the QBI concept, eliminating the reference to intangible income. And so now the benefit broadens out. It's basically any returns on exported services or exported goods, you know, you can get the FDII benefit. This expands the universe of taxpayers who can take advantage of FDII. So interesting, just by the change in what it's focused on, it used to be that either taxpayers with low margin income might not have been able to take advantage of the FDII deduction, or capital intensive taxpayers had just too much domestic expenses and couldn't take advantage of FDII. Those limitations are gone now. And so more taxpayers will be able to take advantage of FDII. So that's a pretty notable change. Again, like the change to GILTI, the rate has now gone up. So we've gone from 13.125% to 14%. So maintaining the symmetry between FDII or FDII now and necktie now, our CFC income. So removing disincentives. Expense apportionment, we're not going to allocate interest expense or R&D against FIDE, another benefit here, a significant benefit. On the downside, under the TCJA, it used to be that I could benefit from FIDE if I had royalty income from licensing IP, or I could benefit if I sold or otherwise transferred the IP offshore and had an income inclusion. But in the spirit of sort of making it in America and promoting kind of domestic growth, they've eliminated the benefit for sending the tree, if you would, overseas. So now sales of IP or of any other property that gives rise to depreciation, amortization, or depletion, or in the case of IP, 367D transfers. So if I had 351 IP to a CFC and I have a deemed royalty inclusion over time, I can't benefit from FIDE from transferring IP overseas anymore. I can only benefit for, if you would, the fruit of my IP or from rental income. So a pretty big change. Not many taxpayers were systematically taking advantage of this, but it was an opportunity to move your portfolio of IP or otherwise between US and foreign at a discounted rate. That discount has ended, and it actually applies to transfers after June 16th, 2025. So you know, once the introduction of the Senate bill came, that closed the door on being able to transfer out the trees, if you would, for purposes of qualifying for FIDE.
Thanks, Ron. But obviously, it doesn't impact a 367D royalty for a pre-6/16/25 transfer. So that's good. Yep. So yep. Taking all account all the GILTI and FIDE modifications, on balance, would you expect taxpayers to see a benefit from these changes?
Yeah, I mean, I think as we've discussed it, there's some good and some bad in both the FIDE and GILTI rules, and it'll be kind of highly fact dependent, and you know, break out your model and start trying to understand how these rules affect any particular taxpayer, and it might well vary. In general, you know, if we just step back and look at the GILTI changes, on the positive side, not having expense allocation for foreign tax credit purposes is a major positive. And then there are two things that are bad now. We have the loss of QBI. So now instead of creating exempt income from our QBI shield on earnings, that is all going to be subject to necktie and also the rate change. So you're balancing expense allocation broadly and the loss of QBI and rate for the CFC world. On the FIDE side of things, it's a little bit different. So the goods are expense allocation. So again, no expense allocation against FIDE income or in determining your FIDE deduction. But also for FIDE, not having QBI is a good thing. And so those are the positives. The downside really is just the rate change. So 13.125% to 14%. And that's what taxpayers will be weighing against just in looking at how they're affected by these changes.
So GILTI and FIDE have always been effectively, in some sense, or intended to be at least, neutral. The taxpayers have always had to look at their own profile and determine whether to benefit from the lower FIDE rate or transfer income into the GILTI rate. Would you expect these changes to move the needle much so that taxpayers might prefer, for instance, FIDE rather than necktie or vice versa?
Yeah, there's a few different lenses on this. In general, I think the FIDE changes will prove to be kind of more generous. And so FIDE kind of is a little bit ahead of the game now from where it was just under the TCJA. This is going to raise a few different issues. I think in general, taxpayers are now going to, you know, reassess, what am I doing in branches and CFCs today? Is that supporting U.S. market stuff? Is that supporting foreign market stuff? And would it make sense to move any of that onshore? I think that's been an evaluation that people have been undertaking, but I think it's just become more important. The other aspect, what's your existing footprint and should that change? There's also like, how am I going to spend my next dollar as a company? Am I going to invest onshore or offshore? You know, and there is something to be said for, you know, investing in the U.S. Well, there are other changes within this legislation relating to bonus depreciation and building factories and production that kind of favor making it in America. And so the incremental, where's the next dollar spent decision might well be influenced by these provisions. And again, the U.S. side of things might well win out. For saying all that, we still have a bunch of, or a couple at least, prominent minimum taxes that are floating out there that are relevant. So, and we'll get into them in a bit more detail, but we have the BEAT that's out there. And if you have kind of too much benefits in the U.S., you can have a clawback. The corporate alternative minimum tax, or CAMT, is out there affecting large taxpayers, but the universe might well grow and its impact will become more important and be more closely scrutinized because of the positive rate changes under the regular tax. And also, at least for foreign multinationals, Pillar 2 seems to be still out there. And so income inclusion rules at the foreign parent level are still relevant to U.S. operations. And so there might well be limitations on how much U.S. companies can benefit just because of these minimum tax provisions that are out there as well.
Those are really good points. So we'll come back to B and CAMT a little bit later. Other than the FIDI modifications, did the bill make any additional changes relevant to the taxation of exporters?
Yeah, there's one other provision that, at least for me, kind of snuck up on us. But under the TCJA, we had the production sourcing rule. So 863B got changed. And so if I produced in the United States and I sold offshore, it just didn't matter. Production ruled and it's all U.S. source income, not good for the foreign tax credit. The OB3 introduced a new provision that says, oh, by the way, if I produce in the U.S., but I sell through a foreign office or fixed place of business, I can get some foreign source and presumably branch basket income to the extent of that income that's allocable to the branch. And so this is going to be a distribution branch, so you might not expect to have a lot of profit in there. But you know, at the margin, we're going to move, or have the potential to move, from just U.S. source for U.S. produced stuff to a mix of U.S. and foreign source for things that are produced in the U.S. but sold through a foreign office or fixed place of business. So interesting little change in there. And again, seemingly popped up out of nowhere.
Thanks, Ron. So I understand that there were some other changes to CFC taxation. Can you summarize what else changed there?
For me, the biggest was we have permanence around 954C6. It was a 5-year extender now, and you know, there was concerns it was going to be year to year. It wasn't included in the House bill at all, but you know, the Senate kind of rode to the rescue. And now we have the CFC look-through rule is kind of just permanent law, which is a pretty positive development. We also had some pretty dramatic changes to the pro rata share rules. So this is section 951. Basically, this is going to affect M&A transactions. So when I sell a CFC, or if a CFC gets decontrolled, U.S. shareholders are going to pick up based on the number of days they own the stock during the year on which the company was a CFC. So we've lost at least the rule that said, oh, by the way, it's the U.S. shareholder holding on the last day of the year in which it was a CFC that kind of catches all the subpart F income. Now, if there's a sale, for example, between a U.S. shareholder seller and a U.S. shareholder buyer, those two will allocate one way or another. There's some reg authority around that, but we'll allocate the subpart F and GILTI income between them based on days of ownership. So a pretty big change there. In addition, we had the restoration of the exclusion of downward attribution. So this is the 958B4 rule, kind of coming out of TCJA. CFC stock could be attributed from a foreign person to a U.S. person. And this created CFCs kind of all over the place, even if you didn't have direct U.S. shareholders necessarily. The rule was pretty problematic. Treasury wrote a lot of guidance to kind of rein it in, but the statutory provision still remained. We've now gotten rid of, or restored at least, the prevention of downward attribution under Section 958B4 and got back to more of what the pre-TCJA Section 958 rules look like. But then we also added Section 951 Cap B. And so this is addressing foreign-controlled foreign corporations and foreign-controlled U.S. shareholders. So when you have foreign-parented groups and a U.S. company and then a foreign company below that, we're going to determine CFC and U.S. shareholder status by, in this case, allowing attribution down from the foreign parent, so a majority owner, down to its U.S. sub. And so basically it's preserving what the current law provided, so what the TCJA provided, but it's just limiting its scope so it's more targeted appropriately, if you would. So all of these provisions are effective for tax years beginning after 12/31/2025, so coming up at the end of the year.
So, Ron, would you expect these changes to have effects on any other provisions relating to CFCs?
Yeah, the biggest, the most prominent is going to be, we have a pretty ornate reg package under Section 245A-5 that deals with, in this case, extraordinary reduction transactions. But basically, under current law, because of the operation of the pro rata share rules, and there's a provision within 951A2B, that basically allowed current year subpart F and guilty inclusions to kind of escape. So not be taxed in the hands of the seller and not be taxed in the hands of the buyer. And these 245A regulations created these kind of intricate and kind of controversial rules to address this and prevent income from escaping the U.S. tax net. The changes to the pro rata share rules and the changes around 958B4 and 951 cap B all kind of work to address that. So I think those regulations are now no longer necessary. More broadly, there are other provisions in the foreign tax credit rules. You know, now that we don't have to deal with expense allocation in the same way, there are probably some rules that are less important, or the effects now are, you know, we might actually have to do them, but they are going to be relevant for determining how much interest expenses allocated to U.S. source income, which is kind of a weird notion.
Ron, you mentioned earlier that B could be a counterweight to some of these more taxpayer favorable measures. What changed with respect to B in the OB3?
It's kind of interesting. The House didn't have much on it. Senate had these dramatic changes, but then they all went away, so we won't deal with it. So actually, BEAT's footprint really didn't change too much. The only substantive change to the statute was the rate moved from 10% to 10.5%. So a relatively modest change there. But otherwise, the legislation just basically restores or preserves the current law treatment of, for example, GBCs and foreign tax credits. And so not much has changed with respect to BEAT, but everything else around BEAT has kind of changed. And so as we discussed, there are a lot more opportunities now to reduce your U.S. tax bill, and BEAT and CAMTI become more relevant in that context.
So can you elaborate on why BEAT and CAMTI could be problematic following the passage of this legislation?
Well, why don't we unpack it a little bit, focus just on a couple other things that changed. So Section 163J, we had some dramatic changes there to our rules on how much interest expense is deductible by corporate taxpayers. The big news was the restoration of the DA, depreciation and amortization, now get added back into the 30% of adjusted taxable income limitation. So basically a positive, right? There's a bigger universe of taxable income and you get to deduct interest expense up to 30% of that. That provision is actually retroactive to tax years beginning after 12/31/24. So it's a 2025 provision that's helpful. There were a couple not so helpful provisions. One, interest expense that gets capitalized under any of the elective capitalization provisions that used to be excluded from being considered as interest expense for purposes of 163J. Now that capitalized interest, electively capitalized interest, is included. So that's expanding the footprint of interest that's subject to capitalization. In addition, under current law, there are proposed regs that are reliable that allow taxpayers to take into account subpart F income and guilty income in the Section 78 gross up in taxable income. So there's a final reg that says don't. There's a proposed reg that allows you to take into account these amounts. The OB3 comes along and says, no more of that. You can't take into account subpart F income, guilty income, or the Section 78 gross up in computing your Section 163J taxable income. And so those two provisions, the capitalized interest and the CFC income provision, are both effective for taxable years beginning after 12/31/25. So it's like kind of weird. We have 2024 rules for 163J, which doesn't have the DA. We have 2025 rules that reinstall the DA, depreciation and amortization, to taxable income. And then going forward, we're going to have permanent rules starting in 26 that allow depreciation and amortization, but then claw back CFC income and include capitalized interest as bad interest expense for purpose of 163J. So pretty big changes there. The second place that's kind of impactful for like BEAT or CAMT broadly is section 174. So R&D expensing is back. So for R&D expenses from taxable years beginning after 12/31/24, you can deduct immediately if you want. You can capitalize for up to 60 months if you want. You can take R&D expenses. And again, this is just domestic R&D expenses. So I'll just pause on that. But importantly, this is all for domestic R&D. You can deduct, capitalize up to 60 months, or make an election under Section 59E and capitalize it over 10 years. So a lot of flexibility, but a lot more potential deductibility in the system this year. Foreign R&D doesn't get this benefit. So we're still under TCJA rules for that. And so 15-year amortization for foreign R&D occurring in CFCs, for example, or in branches. So both of these provisions, so 163J and 174, you know, for BEAT, you might well have more related party payments that are deductible now and therefore are caught up in the BEAT calculation, our base erosion payments. And, you know, just something taxpayers will have to model and figure out. For CAMT, as much as anything, we're looking at regular tax versus book tax, and your deductibility of interest can matter there and affect, create differences, and your 174 deduction can have a similar effect. So things to look at kind of going forward because of broader changes within OB3.
Yeah, the effect of 163J and 174 mandatory capitalization, at least with respect to CAMT, which I'm more familiar with, was to relieve a lot of taxpayers of a CAMT liability, right? Because it drove up their regular tax relative to their alternative tax. And I think that's similar in the context of BEAT.
So thanks, Ron. That the legislative process leading to the enactment of OB3 was interesting might be the understatement of the year. So was there anything that stood out to you, anything that could have an impact on future tax policy?
A few things. There was some conjecture, at least, that, you know, because of the close margins in the House, this would be the House kind of driving things. But at the end of the day, it was the Senate bill that made the dramatic changes, and that really drove the ultimate answer in the House, which is usually how legislation kind of works. And it did play out here. And so that was interesting. There's a lot of discussion now about another reconciliation bill, and maybe that's a way to kind of placate everybody. I think that'll be interesting to watch for. But more directly in this process, it's really all about the Senate. And so, you know, we saw the use of current policy baseline. So basically what happened was temporary provisions in the TCJA, they had to be temporary, so they didn't cost that much to stay within the TCJA's reconciliation numbers. But now when we come to OB3, those provisions were deemed to be basically permanent. They were the ongoing law, and they were viewed at least as setting the budget baseline. And it sort of set the precedent, at least, that the budget committee or the Senate itself gets to set its own budget. And it isn't the Congressional Budget Office budget, for example, that actually matters. And so very interesting development. You know, it might have broader implications on just how the Senate works. And certainly you would expect it to impact tax legislation going forward. The other big item was, and this started in the House, but Section 899, I think we touched on it right at the beginning, you know, was in the House bill, a prominent part, was in the first Senate bill. And then it ultimately went away. But the use of the U.S. legislative process as a vehicle in tax diplomacy, this is kind of Treasury and Congress kind of working together to change global tax answers and realign that kind of global tax policy. Just very interesting, happening in kind of real time. And, you know, we have an agreement that is a agreement in principle that has to be effectuated around the world. And we'll see how that works. But, you know, very interesting to see 899, a very harsh rule that nobody ever wanted to really apply. And then it actually turns out to have effect in ongoing negotiations. And ultimately, the legislation gets pulled as part of those ongoing negotiations. So really interesting and to my mind, I think unprecedented.
Ron, is Section 899, in the words of Miracle Max, all dead or just mostly dead?
I think until there is domestic legislation within the G7 and maybe more broadly in the inclusive framework members that have adopted Pillar 2, until we start to see it, I think the threat of Section 899 is still out there. We have this rumblings of a second reconciliation bill, so I wouldn't call it, it's not dead yet.
You took my Princess Bride joke and raised well,
that's
me
a Monty,
with
Python.
Monty Python.
That's a Monty Python
joke. Really, really impressive, Ron.
So as we wrap up today, Ron, any final thoughts?
Yeah, one more big theme. A lot of the Senate proposals, well, the House and the Senate proposals really went toward permanence. And that was a big theme, getting the TCJA made permanent. And they did so with a lot of provisions. They did, however, introduce new temporary provisions, which is interesting. It's also just to reflect on this budget reconciliation process. You know, since 2010, I think this is the fifth instance now of budget reconciliation working on a partisan basis, so one party or the other, driving significant tax legislation. There is kind of permanence in policy, and that's probably helpful, but I don't think there's a permanent platform here. You know, when we have Democrats who get three of a kind between the White House and both branches of Congress, we might well see dramatic changes in tax policy or in tax rates from what we see reflected here. And so that permanence, I think that business kind of craves, we're not there yet.
Thanks, Ron, for your valuable insights on the OB3. And a special thank you to Michael Timmerman for his help behind the scenes with this episode. There's some significant changes for U.S. multinationals in this legislation to grapple with, ones that could shift the way taxpayers have traditionally viewed the international tax landscape. We'll have to see how companies will adapt and react to this new environment. And as Ron mentioned, there could be another reconciliation bill in the near future. Republicans are already talking about a second reconciliation bill for the U.S.'s 2026 fiscal year. As always, please stay tuned for future episodes of KPMG's Inside International Tax to stay up to speed on the latest developments in U.S. international tax. Until our next episode, take care.